Hello and good evening. This is Lisa Gar. Welcome to Coast AM. Tonight we're going to go on another fascinating journey to seek answers to the question, is it possible for intelligent life to exist on other planets? Joining me in the first hour is Robert Powell. He's the current director of research at MUFON, and he recently wrote an article called Something Intelligent This Way Comes. He wrote that in the Journal of Astrobiology. And he talks about our scientific breakthroughs in the last 100 years have been increasing at an exponential rate. He's going to share some of those studies with us and talk about some more advanced space-based technologies that are going to be giving us the ability to look for signs of life, which is wonderful. That's in the first hour. And joining me later in the show is Paul Von Ward. He's an interdisciplinary cosmologist and an independent scholar, and he's going to talk about his latest book, Children of a Living Universe. He addresses the question, where are we in the evolutionary trajectory of our species? That is later on in the show. Both of these talk whips when we come back. I'm sitting in for Rob Simone tonight. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar. And joining me is Robert Powell. He's the current director of research at MUFON. And he recently wrote an article called Something Intelligent This Way Comes. Welcome to the show, Robert. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks, Lisa. Thanks for having me on. It's good to be back again.
Yeah. So you have a great article here. I love this. It's all about the latest scientific breakthroughs about the increasing rate of life on other planets. And there's a lot of evidence so far that you've come up with. Can you share some of this with us about how many Earth-like planets have been discovered lately?
Well, there are over 3,600 potential Earth-like. Let me back up a little bit. They're not all Earth-like candidates. Some of them are like the size of Jupiter. So we've discovered over 3,600 planets, not within our solar system, but orbiting other stars. A certain percentage of those are Earth-like.
In what way? What way validates that?
One of the key things that you look for is that the planet is orbiting its sun in such a way that we would suspect that water could remain liquid during at least a portion of its year. And that's always key for the formation of life as we know it, is that you have liquid water available.
Now, a lot of this water, as I read, is frozen very deep within these planets. How is that determined?
Well, the water that we know of, that, for example, that's frozen, is some of the water within our own solar system. Three of the moons of Jupiter have, one of the moons of Jupiter has an ocean that we suspect is 60 miles deep. That's the moon Europa, and it's frozen solid. So I talked about those moons of Jupiter just to give people an idea that water is very common throughout the universe. It's not unique to the planet Earth. And these other planets that we found orbiting other stars, we don't know yet if there's water on those planets, but we know that water is common throughout the universe, and we know that some of those planets are orbiting around their star at a point where water could remain a liquid.
Is it possible that life forms could exist on those planets?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it's probably likely, because it seems that if you have the right conditions, life seems to always form. Now, we don't know that for certain yet, but there are indications that that's the case. And that's why you have, for example, SETI, who actually goes out looking for intelligent life using radio telescopes. So there are plenty of scientists that believe it is reasonable to try to find intelligent life in other solar systems.
Now, there's a lot more advanced, those space-based technologies. Can you tell us about those, and what types of technologies are available in these telescopes that could actually look for these signs of life?
Well, the type of telescopes we've been able to find the stars we have so far are actually fairly primitive. We have one where we look at basically the gravitational tug of a planet on its star. So about all that allows you to find is large planets, such as Jupiter, that are very close to their star and can tug on the star. But the most successful has been what the Kepler telescope uses, which is called the transit method. And that's basically a type of planet that's in alignment between its star and the Earth so that it is actually blocking some of the light of the star. And so the way we detect the planet is detecting that the amount of light of the star drops suddenly.
So this is pretty recent data, December 2013. That must have been pretty exciting.
Right, yeah, and that's recent. And there's even greater capabilities that will be coming up on the horizon. There's the James Webb Telescope. That will be launched in 2018, which will be more powerful than Kepler. But the really good telescope is one that's being worked on by Guthrie Aerospace, and it's going to be called the New Worlds. And basically, how it's different is that it's going to use a technique where they actually mask the star out so that the light of the star is not outshining the planet, so that that way we can actually look at the planet and determine what's in its atmosphere.
This is fascinating. You mentioned in your article that, what is it, Seth Shostak has estimated that in all likelihood there's at least 30,000 habitable worlds within 1,000 light years of Earth. Explain this. What do you mean by habitable worlds?
By habitable worlds, he's talking about worlds that are potentially habitable for life, which means that they're orbiting their star in such a way that water could remain a liquid for at least part of the year. And I think the reason Seth came up with a number as large as 30,000, and Seth, by the way, is one of the key astronomers at SETI, which is our attempts to detect life on other planets using radio telescopes. So we're trying to find other life that, you know, uses television communications, radio communications like ourselves. But what we've become to realize is that there's more smaller planets than there are larger planets, just as there are more smaller stars than there are larger stars. And the telescopes we have today can really best find the very large planets. They really can't find the small ones. So if you kind of extrapolate, then you would say, wow, if we found this many large planets, there are a humongous number of small planets out there. And by small planets, I mean planets the size of our Earth.
All right, and then by large planets, what do you mean? Like how large?
Like Jupiter, mm-hmm. which Jupiter, for example,'s diameter is 10 times the diameter of Earth. So those are the large planets, which is what we're able to see most easily with our telescopes techniques of today. But in the future, we'll be able to much more easily see planets the size of the Earth.
Future about how long, how far away do you think this is, this type of technology?
Well, the technology on the telescope called New Worlds, which NASA's developing with Northrop Guthrie, is they have not stated a launch date, but I would say probably within the next 20 years.
Okay. I mean, of course, there's exciting stuff that happens daily, but we only get a small snippet of it, and I can understand that. Tell me, what made you write the article, though? Something Intelligent This Way Comes. It's a unique title.
Right. I wrote the article because I wanted to basically try to get across the idea that if we believe intelligent life exists out there in the galaxy, right, and many of our scientists today now believe that. That's why we have SETI, for example. So if we know and believe that it exists, it's only logical to know that a life form even more intelligent than us certainly would know that we exist. So then the only question becomes, if it knows that we exist, can it get to our world? And most scientists will argue, no, it cannot, because we're limited by the speed of light, and we have no capability of going to other stars. But then you have to ask yourself, how about a civilization that's 1,000 to 10,000 years more advanced than us? Can we say that a civilization that far advanced doesn't have the capability of getting here? It's not something that I would want to bet on. If I had to bet, I would bet they could get here.
And that's what, I mean, that's what MUFON basically is here to establish, is that, explain a little bit about MUFON and what its mission is and your involvement.
Right, MUFON's mission is the scientific study of the UFO phenomenon for the benefit of humanity. So in my particular area within MUFON is the scientific portion of our study. So I try to lend as much scientific credence to our work and investigations as we can, and which is part of the reason I wrote this article. For example, you'll notice in the article, I never use the word UFO because there's so much stigma around that word that to use it, you're never going to be able to publish something in a scientific publication.
What do you use instead?
I just never use that word. The entire article is basically just based on logic, right? Based on what we know today, right? So we just kind of step through it, right? We know planets exist out there. We know that water is just ubiquitous throughout the universe, so it's common. We know that, and we believe that intelligent life exists out there, which is why SETI exists as an organization. So the question becomes, if we know all those things, why can't we just take the next step and say, well, let's consider whether or not it's capable of reaching us?
Right.
Because, right, we know that if we know intelligent life exists out there, right, and we're not that far from being able to look at the atmospheres of other planets to figure that out, well, the civilization 100 years ahead of us has already done that. So they already know we're here. And a civilization 100 years ahead of us, they can't get here just like we can't get there because their understanding of physics is at the same level ours is, so there's no way for interstellar travel. But I think that breaks down when you get to civilizations that are 1,000 years more advanced than us.
Absolutely. So, I mean, how do you know, though, they haven't attempted to contact us? Isn't that what many of these organizations have attempted to verify?
Right. And so, for example, SETI is using radio telescopes, and they're looking at mostly in a particular frequency of the electromagnetic bandwidth. They're looking at around 1 to 3 gigahertz, and which is where you have your radio transmissions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because when SETI was first founded, that was back in the 70s, the way they thought they could detect other intelligent civilizations is they looked at our own, right? And they said, okay, so what are we emitting from the Earth that another civilization could detect? And television and radio were two frequencies that were strong enough that they could detect it if another civilization was doing the same thing. So it assumes a couple of things. It assumes another civilization develops like ours, that they use frequencies such as radar, TV, and radio. And so the only problem there is things have already changed within our own civilization. Think about where we'll be in 20 to 30 years. TV and radio will be gone probably in 20
right.
to 30 years, right? The internet is taking them out of business.
Uh-huh.
Well, so now you don't have your radio waves going out into space. You don't have your TV waves going out into space. We are shrinking things and using less and less power. Things run on less and less voltage. Wireless internet is not something that transmit waves into outer space. So a more advanced civilization than us may not even be emitting those strong wavelengths that we were emitting a lot of in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
What about the NASA satellites and the increase of the amount of satellites?
Yeah, we have a lot of, for example, GPS satellites that, you know, are beaming information back to the Earth.
Right.
Back and forth to the Earth.
Down to us, so, yeah.
Pardon?
Yeah, down to us. What about the other direction?
Yeah, so they're not really just beaming out into outer space. So it's difficult to, one, decide, okay, what frequencies do these other civilizations that we really know nothing about, I mean, in reality, we don't even know if they exist. It's always possible we're all alone. But we believe that there's a likelihood they exist, but we're guessing when we say, okay, well, they probably have communication in a 1 to 3 gigahertz range, which is, you know, the same as radio and TV. So I think that's part of the reason why SETI has not been successful in finding a signal out there.
I mean, there's so much research that's been done, and even, you know, 96, you mentioned that NASA launched this breakthrough propulsion physics program. I mean, that was a while ago. You would think that there is a lot more that we have not been told. You do so much research on this. Are there things that you notice that you have been able to determine on your own that is not out in the media yet?
Well, you know, the military is always going to be probably 10 to 20 years ahead of where our current technology is. But usually you can kind of guess about where they're at and some of their capabilities. So we're usually able to have a pretty good feel for what's possible and what's not possible in terms of aircraft capabilities.
I mean, there's got to be updates since 96, since they launched the program. Do you know of any?
They had a meeting, for example, in 2011, which was basically a brainstorm meeting. It was put on by NASA and DARPA. DARPA is a research arm of the military. And what they were wanting to determine is, can we come up with unique ways that would allow us to sometime in the future develop interstellar travel? So that tells you something right there. That tells you that they consider it a possibility, and they're interested in looking at the possibilities there. So it's not like they don't think it's possible to travel interstellar distances. But it's probably 100 to 200 years in our future. It's nothing we can do anytime soon.
These new the telescopes are fascinating, about the ones that block out the light. So they can literally see within 1,000 light years of Earth?
They'll probably be concentrating within the first 100 light years on the first planets that they look at, and they'll probably use information they learned from the Kepler telescope. But the basic idea would be that with this new type of telescope, you block out the star's light so that you can actually look with a spectroscope the atmosphere of the planet that's orbiting that star. So that way you can determine, is there oxygen in the atmosphere, is there nitrogen, what are the wavelengths of light that are being emitted through that planet's atmosphere?
This is just so fascinating to me, and I have a lot more questions here. We're going to take some calls after the break, but I wanted to ask you about MUFON again. You said the scientific study of UFOs for the benefit of humanity. Explain that. Explain the benefit of humanity part of that.
Well, my view of that is always it's the benefit of having the information and providing information and explanations to the public as to what you think the UFO phenomenon is. And I consider it a phenomenon because we don't understand exactly what it is and what causes it. I mean, we all have our theories as to what it is. My personal belief is that the most likely cause is not, well, let me back up. 99% of what people may think they see is usually explainable, but there's this small percentage that's not explainable. And I think when you look at that, the best bet is that it's probably extraterrestrial. That doesn't mean it is, but if I had to come up with an explanation right now, that would be my best explanation.
If 99%, though, are explainable, what are they explainable by?
Well, usually someone sees the planet Venus but they don't recognize it as Venus, or they see an aircraft at night, or they see a Chinese lantern, a series of them floating across the sky, and it looks like a, you know, some people think it's a fleet of UFOs. There's a lot of those misperceptions as to what people see. But there's a small percentage that, especially when an object is very close to an individual, where you can't really explain that off as a planet or a star or an aircraft or something like that.
Okay, so that makes sense. So I understand the benefit of humanity, and we're going to come back and take some listener questions as well. A lot of questions coming in from the listeners, and find out more. Again, my guest is Robert Powell. The article, recent article that he wrote, is called Something Intelligent This Way Comes, talking about intelligent life on other worlds. Intelligent life on other worlds. And has that intelligent life detected us? We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come right back. Welcome back. My guest is Robert Powell. He's the current director of research at MUFON. He also wrote an article called Something Intelligent This Way Comes. It's about scientific breakthroughs in the last 100 years have been increasing at an exponential rate. And now, within the next few decades, actually, there will be more advanced space-based telescopes. One of them is called the New Worlds Telescope, that'll give us the capability to look for these signs of life and hopefully signs of intelligent life. Let me ask you a question, Robert. What would happen today if NASA came out and said, we have found intelligent life on other planets? News alert.
Yeah, that is a good question. Myself, I don't think much would happen at all. I think people would just continue going about their lives as they always do. They would probably still be more interested in, you know, the elevator escapades of that we see on the evening news than probably is there life on other planets.
Are you saying that it's an all-about-me society and it'll come and go out of the news just like everything else?
Yes, I think it will. I think it would. It's, you know, as long as intelligent life is not here, you know, not visiting us, and it's just out there somewhere, then I don't think it really affects people too much. Now, you know, most of your listeners, that's probably not the same answer, because they're obviously have called in because they're interested in it. But the public at large, I don't think is.
Interesting. Well, let's go to some of those callers. Let's go to Jim, west of the Rockies. Jim, do you have a question for Robert Powell?
You hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Hi.
Okay. I'd like to know how far out a satellite can go and still send pictures back to us here on Earth.
Good question. Robert?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good question, Jim. We've had photos sent back to Earth as far away as the planet Neptune. So our spacecraft that go out can send photos back to the Earth almost to the edge of our solar system.
Almost to the edge. So have there ever been satellites that have, you know, of course, floated out into the atmosphere and not come back?
Of course, these aren't actually satellites, because satellites imply that they're orbiting the Earth. So all of our satellites can send pictures back to the Earth. But some of our spacecraft, which actually leave the gravitational field of the Earth completely, have sent back photographs from as far away as photos of the moons of the planet Neptune.
Great. All right. Great question. All right. We're going to actually take another quick break, and we come back, we're going to take more of your phone calls. Thank you very much. We'll be right back. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. This is Lisa Gar. My guest is Robert Powell, the current director of research at MUFON. We're talking about intelligent life on other worlds, and I'm going to go right to callers here. Got a lot of great people calling in questions for you. Robert, are you ready for that?
Sure.
All right, we're going to keep going. Let's see here for Dave, west of the Rockies. Dave, do you have a question for Robert Powell?
I just have more of a comment. I'm a former fighter pilot in the Air Force, and I'm a little more skeptical than it sounds like you are about whether people have or whether aliens have visited the Earth. One of the things that kind of bugged me over time has been when I was flying at Luke Air Force Base in Arizona, I was flying F-16s over there, and I remember one of the big sightings happened right when I was there. And to me, looking at it on the TV, it was obvious what it was. It was an F-16 launching flares, which are, you know, those are hot things that heat-seeking missiles will go after. You know, sort of trying to save, is what they use to save their lives. You know, it's a flare that launches out of the F-16. Mm. But, I still see it on TV, even though it's been completely debunked. I still see people connecting the dots and turning that into a giant UFO. And even though it's completely, it kind of bothers me that people, even though they're shown evidence that show that what that was not a UFO, obviously to me, absolutely without a doubt. I still see it on TV all the time. So, I mean, I'm a little bit more skeptical. I think there probably is intelligent life out there, but in my opinion, it's just a little too difficult to get here. And I don't think any of them have ever, you know, I'm very skeptical about whether anyone would come here and show up and...
I appreciate your...
Some guy out in the high level.
No, I appreciate your skepticism, and I appreciate your service, by the way, as well. Thank you for that. But let me ask you a question. What is the shape of an F-16? Is it triangular?
The shape of it? No, it's more like they call it the lawn dart because they tend to crash a lot, and it's a little bit shaped like a lawn dart. So, yeah. And also these triangular, you know, things that people are seeing, they've actually come out with what, you know, a lot of drones that have just recently come out that are, you know, they're shaped like that, and the government's trying not to let them be seen by people. And I think it's a huge jump to say that it's a UFO an alien spaceship.
I agree with you that you're referring to the Phoenix Lights, and that photograph that's normally shown, I agree 100%. Those appear to me also to be military flares that were dropped. The part of the Phoenix Lights that's more interesting, and I don't think it's, you know, necessarily one of the better cases that has occurred in history, but the part that's more interesting is the daytime sightings of individuals in that area who said they saw a gigantic triangular object. Now, you know, whether or not they really saw that or not, I don't know, but to me that's the more interesting part. The flares that were photographed were definitely flares, in my opinion.
I think that you know, you have to use Occam's razor and see which is more likely to happen. Is it more likely that you know, people see, they may have been thinking about UFOs and that's kind of what they saw, you know, because that's what their mind might be playing tricks on them, or they're wearing glasses that have reflections on them. And I think that it's very, very unlikely that a extraterrestrial would travel light years away from where they live to come here only to do absolutely nothing, you know. I don't think that's likely.
Right. Well, you know, you might want to read, it's a very serious type of book that myself and other individuals wrote. It's called UFOs and Government, a Historical Inquiry. And we deal basically with just factual type documents that we receive through FOIAs from the government. And it starts in World War II, and it comes up to modern day. And we deal with what we consider some of the stronger cases that have occurred over history. One of the most interesting ones was an RB-47, which I don't know if you're familiar with. It was kind of original AWACS that they used, a B-47, they converted to it. And it basically was tracked by a UFO for over 2 hours. The UFO was picked up by the RB-47, also by ground radar, and it was seen by the pilots of the RB-47.
That's interesting. I just think there are other, you know, like, again, Occam's razor, there are probably other explanations for that out there that are less difficult to have occurred. It could very well have been that. So why would an extraterrestrial come light years away just to be seen by a B-47 and then leave?
Yeah,
I just make
that. I mean, and plus it would take them about, what, 60 years for a round trip or something like that. It would take a long...
Well, if they had our technology, it would take
I mean, the speed of light, as far as we know, is finite, and that's the speed limit, apparently. I mean, unless they're holes and different bends of the
which we've
universe.
Discussed. Yes. Well, thank you very much for your call. And again, thank you very much for your service. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave.
All right. Let's go back to the callers. It's our wild card line, Daniel from Fort Smith, Arkansas. Are you, do you have a question for Robert Powell?
Yes. Actually, I've got a question and a comment. Lisa, I think I'm an attorney red right now, but I love when you come on. I swear
Thank you.
I could listen to you read the phone book. Your voice is that soothing.
I'm red, but, yes. Pretty red. Thank you, though.
my question is, I've read some different literature from Christian Scientists, and when I say that, I don't mean the religion, I mean just scientists that are Christian. I couldn't give you their names off the top of my head, but what they would say is that if the earth was tilted in just 1 degree or a couple degrees in either direction, that nothing could survive on the planet, not even bacteria. And I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on that. And I'm going to go ahead and hang up and just listen for your answer.
Thanks for your call.
That's a very good question, and that in the paper, that's one of the items that I point out, is that many scientists, that's one of their arguments as to why life is unique on the Earth, because our axis is tilted in an exact angle that allows us to have the seasons. We have a metal iron core, which allows us to have a Van Allen radiation belt, which protects the Earth from solar storms. And we have Jupiter placed out just in the right spot of the solar system to keep the asteroids from constantly pelting the Earth, which they did in the beginning of the Earth's development.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some very strong arguments as to why life is unique here and it doesn't exist anywhere else. And I point that out in the paper I wrote. But there's also equally strong arguments is just from history that life is not unique. I mean, we've always felt that we were unique. For a while, we thought that the Earth was the center of the universe, mm-hmm. then it was the sun, then we thought it was our solar system, and now we know it's none of the above. We've always felt that humans were unique even on the Earth and that we were the only animal that used our hands to develop and to use tools with our hands. And now we know that chimpanzees do that with sticks. We know there's even a crow, a type of crow that uses a twig as a tool. So things that we used to think, you know, were unique to us, we now know are not. So it just becomes a question, okay, based on history, do we think that life here is unique? Especially when we see that water is everywhere in the universe. But that's a very good question, and we won't know the exact answer for 20 to 30 years, probably.
Well, I mean, I could see what you are doing here is you're finding evidence in both directions. And, I mean, evidence, of course, is up for investigation as well, as everything is. But the importance here is the impact that this information has on society and on those listening who want more information on this. So you present a good argument either way. Let's go back to the phones here. We've got our wild card line, Dan from Tampa, Florida. Dan, do you have a question for Robert Powell?
Yes, I had a question. Good morning, Lisa.
Hi.
My question is, I'm pretty familiar with most of all the radio telescope antennas that they are, even the latest one that's come on. I think it's over in Argentina. I'm familiar mm-hmm. with the NASA plane that has a satellite in it. I'm familiar with all the ones in Hawaii and all that. My question was, I understand that there was a virtual antenna that's going to be coming online. It's going to be linking all these universities together, all their computers, and it's making it virtual. This way, the antenna is actually the size of a planet, which would be so much larger. I was wondering if Robert was familiar with that, and if he is, has he heard anything lately about it?
Well, Dan, I'm not real familiar with it, probably no more than you are, but I have heard about it. And the basic concept is where you have telescopes at geographic points, and you connect them through a computer so that the net effect is you have one large telescope. And I suspect, because this has happened before, that type of system may actually even do better than some of the systems we're going to put up into orbit. But, you know, time will tell if that turns out to be the case.
We talked about a little bit this last Saturday about this with my guest David Sarita about this 12-mile-long telescope with the coils around it. And was that what you're referring to?
No, this one's a virtual telescope.
Okay.
And when it comes online, it's supposed to be the size of half the planet, you know, the Earth.
Mm.
And it's using a virtual to be able to see further out and read, you know, because it's so massive, the planet, versus MUFON and all those little ones trying to link them together.
This well, I
virtual
mean,
virtual one the size of the Earth.
There's no doubt that there's technologies out there that we are not versed in and that we have not been told about. And we think that the smartphone is amazing and that's old technology. So I appreciate your question and thanks for the information. I appreciate it. I think we have time for another caller here. We've got in our wild card line here, Carlos in Carson, California. Carlos, do you have a question for Robert Powell?
Yes, good evening, Lisa and Robert. Robert, what if there was a phony extraterrestrial landing that was all bizarre and done through, let's say, holographic technology, making it appear so real, it would create such panic on Earth that people would readily unite under a world government? After all, Henry Kissinger and Ronald Reagan said that would be an excellent idea for forcing people into a world government. Of course, we know that the powers that be have been working towards a world government. And to me, all this propaganda that I hear about the imminent appearance of aliens, to me, it's very suspect. I'm not totally sold on this idea.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you there, Carlos. I don't think there's going to be any imminent appearance of aliens or anything like that. So you've got a good point. I don't know that is anything that's going to happen in the near future.
Well, I appreciate your... What was that, Carlos?
Well, we hear so much about UFOs, but those UFOs, it could be ancient technologies that were developed maybe in Atlantis, and not necessarily aliens, and it could be that humans that are monitoring or driving these UFOs. UFO doesn't necessarily mean that there's alien involvement in it, you know, and if people are sold that on the concept that it is.
Right, that's why I call it the UFO phenomenon, because you don't know exactly what the true cause is. Right now, all we can do is theorize.
Well, and I appreciate your call, Carlos. Now, I got to ask you about the robotic drones that our other caller, Dave, the fighter pilot, was asking about. Have these UFOs ever been mistaken for these robotic drones?
Oh, yeah, you're right, Lisa. We get a lot of mistaken UFO reports that are basically robotic drones. And now the one that really causes a lot are these little toy robotic drones that everyone can go buy, and they have lights flashing on them, and they can put them up in the sky. Those cause a lot of false UFO reports.
You said 99% of the sightings are explainable. How far up can those the new toys fly?
Oh, you know, I'm not sure. I think they could probably go up 100 feet or so, but when it's at night, even if it's only up 50, 70 feet, and it's small, to someone who looks at it, they might think it's some large object that's far away, even though it's a small object up close.
So in your work and in your research, as you are the director of research at MUFON, and you found that 99% of these sightings are explainable, what causes you to go after that 1%?
That's a very good question. There's two big things that drive me towards trying to understand the whole UFO phenomenon. One is, once you've interviewed enough people and you keep running into people who see something in the daytime, that's, let's say they say, I saw a disc, it's only 100 feet away, it's this size, right, it's huge. At that point, you have to eliminate that somebody saw a star or saw a helicopter, right? At that point, either, number one, they're telling the truth, or number two, they're hallucinating, or number three, they're a liar. I mean, it's one of the three. There's no other possibility. And I've talked to so many people that it's like, there's got to be something to this. And then when you add to it some of these other cases, like that RB-47 case I mentioned, and a lot of other military cases that we have listed in our book that's on your website.
Robert, by the way, could you give that website real quick, because we're about out of time here?
Sure. It's your Coast to Coast AM website, and the name of the book is UFO and Governments, A Historical
Inquiry. Thank you.